And if you think about the coach as being the person who can dimensionalize your world, right? As a leader, you live in this, imagine it as a flat world and you can't see that third dimension. And then you bring a coach in who's a great coach is a full partner who understands how to help you see that third dimension in your world. We sometimes call it the fifth dimension of the world, because the real dimension that you want to be able to see is the dimension of relationships.
Correct.
Right? And a great coach helps you see the relationships, contextualize them, understand them in a way that you might be blind to. And you're right. It shouldn't be a hidden secret, but I think it's one of the keys to success as a leader.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
So Jacqueline and Scott, let's dive into your backgrounds, 100 coaches, and the work that you do. We just talked before about how the world of partnerships plays a role amongst leaders everywhere. Leaders are thinking about this more than probably they have ever before in their careers, and you and your team are helping them navigate that. So I think there is just such richness in this conversation to be had. Jacqueline, can I start with you a little bit around your background and the backstory? How did you become somebody who was so prolific in the coaching arena?
Wow, it's a big question. I think I'd like to go back in time a little bit and describe who feels to me like a different person as I reflect. There was this very formative time in my life where I was in college, and I remember up until that point I'd been a very competitive person. Had this, what's best for me mentality, very much a driven and achiever type person. But then I had this kind of formative dream, I think right at the start of my senior year of college. And in that dream, I saw, I'd died and I was standing on a cloud and watching this TV screen of my life play out before me. And in it, I saw that as I was rushing around and doing a lot of things and, accomplish this, do that. And it started to pan out a little bit more and more and more. And I started to see that I was missing the people around me, that there were people around me who needed help, that I was actively hurting by my not noticing or by some of the activities that I was doing, which wasn't my intention, but it was the outcome. And it was this thing that once I saw it, I could never unsee it. And I realized that I don't want to be the kind of person that achieves for myself at the expense of another. And I really became convinced that the only way I want to live my life is in partnership with other people. And really, I've come to learn now that that's what leadership is at its core. And that set me on a totally different trajectory where I learned how important it is to work with other people. I was an engineer by training, but I realized very quickly that people problems are the problems I'm most interested in solving, rather than system problems or chemical problems or mechanical problems, but people problems. People problems are very complex, but they're often often the most overlooked as well. And that's what began me on this exploration. I realized that leadership development was very much part of my heart. And lo and behold, Scott and I met each other 4.5 years ago now, and found that we had a very similar heart and enthusiasm for this world of leadership development, that we wanted to help leaders make better decisions. We wanted to help them find the right partners to support them in their growth. And that's a big part of how we got to where we are today.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we start our lives surrounded ultimately by coaches, whether it be in sports or whether it's be in a classroom. And at some point, it feels as though when we get in the early parts of our career, that that requirement or that need or that desire for coaching seems to go by the wayside until at some point our professional career comes screaming back at us and saying, actually, we need some help. We're old enough now to understand that that's a really important part of the equation. Scott, I understand you came from quite a creative background before you came to leadership development. Tell me a little bit about that.
I suspect you're referring to my first career, which I was a fashion and portrait photographer. It's interesting because I've always felt myself to be a collaborator partner in everything. And recently, when we were thinking about this business, I'm reflecting back on my time as a photographer. And photography, especially the way that I was doing it back then, and the way it's done in the category that I was in, is an extremely collaborative business. Extremely collaborative. So, for example, when I was a photographer's assistant, which is where I learned the craft of photography, I worked for a guy who was a Vogue fashion photographer, contract photographer, and every month we'd spend 2 weeks going someplace fabulous in the world, typically with a team of about 12 to 15 people. So there'd be model, there'd be hair, there'd be makeup, there'd be a stylist, there'd be the editor, there'd be assistants and everything else. And we really worked as a unit. The photographer certainly had the vision of what he wanted to create. His name was Dennis Peel. I actually just saw him a couple of weeks ago. He had a vision of what he wanted to create, but the rest of us worked in concert to help create that vision. And actually, in talking to him about our time together, we talked about how he never really saw me as an employee. He saw me as a key collaborator. And that he knew that whatever his vision was, I would be there to create the context to execute that vision. And I took that forward when I became a photographer. And I also built teams of people that I could trust and know and rely on, and recognized that the greatest way to work together is to have people who are extraordinary in their particular area and still understand how to work together as a single unit. And I think that's carried forward throughout my career, no matter what role I've been in. I've always had a key partner that I've been working with.
Let's talk about this idea of coaching and how you define that. And a question for both of you, because I think one of the biggest secrets that live behind great leaders, regardless of where they are in their career or how many careers they've had, is that they have an ecosystem of support. And I'm reluctant to use the term, you know, a board of advisors. I think often there is almost a board of coaching that goes on that helps people sort of move through different challenges. And there are different stages and the needs for the change as you go through a career. So how do you define the idea of coaching for people who have maybe experienced it as a recipient, because early in their careers in sports, they had a coach, but now professionally, where we're navigating so many different things, and you know, we're at the end of the year, we're recording this now on the 19th of December, 2024, at least on my side, and it is a overwhelming, fatigue-rich environment for most leaders. So how do we define coaching?
Yeah, you know, if you don't mind, I'll jump in here, because I want to just say one thing right off the top. Coaching is having a moment, I think. And there's a lot of coaching, a lot of great coaching out there. But not only, I mean, obviously there's good and bad coaches, but coaching is different at different levels of the organization, right? Mm-hmm. So for somebody who's a early stage executive, coaching can be really amazing just to introduce them into what it means to be a leader and help them through some of those. And there's a lot of great coaches out there that do that. Someone in the mid part of their career really can use a coach to help them get from, you know, what we think of as a functional leader to a true leader. Functional leader knows how to do all the work. True leader doesn't know how to do the work. They just know what their job is to sort of set a vision and help the people who they're leading accomplish the jobs that they're doing. But then you get above that and you have the roles of sort of the leaders of the organization, C-suite, CEO, entrepreneurs, people like that. And for them, the challenges are very different. Right. For them, the biggest challenge they have is they don't really have anybody typically who can give them completely unfettered information. Right. Because everybody has some sort of alternative, not in a nefarious way, but they have another agenda. right? You either control their salary or whether they get hired or fired, or it's your, you know, your CEO and this is your board. They control whether you stay or not, so you can communicate in a specific way with them. And it's incredibly isolating. And it's hard to know who to listen to. And by the very nature of those relationships, you have a lot of blind spots.
Yeah.
And if you think about the coach as being the person who can dimensionalize your world, right? As a leader, you live in this, imagine it as a flat world and you can't see that third dimension. And then you bring a coach in who's a great coach, is a full partner, who understands how to help you see that third dimension in your world. We sometimes call it the fifth dimension of the world, because the real dimension that you want to be able to see is the dimension of relationships.
Correct.
Right? And a great coach helps you see the relationships, contextualize them, understand them in a way that you might be blind to. And you're right. It shouldn't be a hidden secret, but I think it's one of the keys to success as a leader.
Jacqueline, how do you build on that? It's a pretty good definition.
Yeah. I typically like to describe coaching as the process by which we can learn, grow, and improve in just about any skill. And so it's becoming much more commonplace for people to get coaching in all different areas and aspects of their lives. I mean, now we have coaches that coach surgeons on how to do surgery better. But the same is very much true for business and for leadership. In fact, there have historically been those theories, like the great man theory, that would tell us that leaders are born, not made. But there's now been a lot of compelling research to the contrary that would say leaders are people who are made and developed. And just like any skill, it takes time and practice to develop. For those who, you know, as Carol Dweck would say, adopt a growth mindset, believe that they can change, are willing to engage in that process. And yes, it is a process. Yes, it is a little messy. But for those who are willing to do so, the rewards are many.
I could not agree more. So as an entrepreneur, as a former CEO who has benefited from coaching support, where I don't think I fully appreciated exactly how powerful it could be, I can attest to both of those things with great clarity. There is a book that you have both co-authored and have been involved in called Becoming Coachable. And it's interesting how, when I think about how I hire and what I look for, and who I want to partner with in the work that I do as a client and as a coach myself, I am looking for that coachability, probably at the top three conditions to make a relationship work. And it's interesting because the idea I think of being coachable is a two-way street. It's certainly not in a single direction, because I find that, and this is the secret I keep from my clients, I get more out of our conversations than I suspect they do. Mm-hmm. So there's often quite a two-way street that goes on here. But tell me a little bit about that publication and why leaders should be looking at this, because the idea of being the only man, as you mentioned before, Jacqueline, and there's sort of being the, you will have all the answers, you will be able to do all of the things, and we have these great expectations that one person will solve everything, I think is completely false. So when you think about this idea of being coachable, tell me about what that actually means for, say, a young leader, maybe someone coming out of college right now, who maybe thinks, I have to beat my chest, I've got to sort of be seen to be, sort of stand out, versus the person who might be pulling their hair out in their middle part of their career, not knowing which direction to take. Where is that being coachable really valuable?
Yeah, wow, it's such a good question. This is really comes back to our reason for writing this book, was we work with a lot of different leaders. It's our profession to help leaders find and get matched with the right coach for them. And so we have now observed hundreds of different coaching engagements, and we were sitting down really trying to explore and understand, why do some leaders go the distance and outperform while some don't? What's the key differentiator? And this was really an insight from our other co-author, Marshall Goldsmith, is that having a great output starts with having a great input. If you want the best outcome, start with a coachable leader. They are going to accomplish the most and get the most from that time together. But to our surprise, when we started Googling around, we didn't find that book anywhere. And it was actually a little surprising to us that that book had not yet been written. And we realized, I think we're the people that were made and meant to write that book. And as our friend Mark Ryder always reminds us, write the book that only you can write. And that's what we sought out to do. And the thing that we really realized is that part of the process of becoming coachable is realizing that there's four key steps. It's about being open. We call this our openness framework in the book. You have to be open to change, open to feedback, open to taking action, and open to being held accountable. And if you start to at least see from the outset that openness to change, I think is a really, really strong indicator that someone can get the rest of the way there. It's a little bit of a self-reinforcing cycle. But we think that's really the key. And I guess I've also been, I want to add this too.
Sure.
I've become very interested in the idea of not just how you do something, like how do you be a leader, but how do you receive something? How do you be a good follower? Not just how do you host a party, but how do you be a good guest at a party? And so this idea of the whole other side of many of these topics is a real fascination. So
yeah, Phil, I feel like you have something you want to share here.
Yeah, look, this is really talking my language. I guess a very quick side story, and we can cut this if we need to. There was a time in my schooling career where I became an army cadet. And I formed a view that I would be a professional military operator for my career. And the commanding officer of our cadet unit, who was a Vietnam veteran, a very well decorated man, said to me one day, and it has really come back to me after what you said, Jacqueline, be a great follower. And then that is the best way to learn how to become a great leader. And we had an option when we graduated school to go to our West Point in Australia, the same kind of system. And many of my colleagues went down that track. I decided to enlist instead. And I remember my first sort of 2 years in the military where I was a private soldier, where we were learning all these things. And I think it was the first 6 years, most formidable of my career, where I learned that the value of knowing what it's like to be a follower will actually pay massive dividend into the future of the career, which I feel as though it has. So if there's anybody who is looking to graduate college, switch into a different career, or make a massive change, I think what we're saying here collectively is don't be afraid to learn what it's like to be a follower. It's often the groundwork to become really something quite special into the future.
I could not agree more. Yeah. And I want to also double click on something you said earlier, Phil, which is that you said you get as much or more out of the coaching work that you do as your clients. And I think that is poignant, because the best coaches are also coachable themselves.
Right.
They have been in the other shoes, right? They've known how to receive that coaching. They know what it's like to receive feedback. And that makes a really big difference. So I could not agree more. If you want to lead, learn to follow.
Yeah. Scott, let me ask you a question around the work that you see with your clients and what they're facing into in terms of partnerships. I've literally come off a conversation this morning which talks about how the global economy is shifting so hard and so fast into a partnership-driven leadership and growth model. What are you seeing with your clients who are trying to work out what the next 5 or 10 years looks like? I imagine they're at the heads of big listed companies that are making changes, and they're also entrepreneurs trying to work out what this means, because obviously what got us here won't get us there. What are you seeing in this arena at the moment around business growth and partnerships?
Yeah, so a couple things. Number one, not only do we coach, but we're the head of 100 Coaches Agency, representing 100 of the best coaches in the world. So not only the input of our own work, but the input of this amazing collective of coaches. I have to say there was a trend. I don't know how long it started, maybe 10 years ago. And companies like Opening Ceremony started doing partnerships with other brands. So you'd have like Opening Ceremony and Nike and Opening Ceremony and Prada and whatever. And I thought at the time it was very novel. But even that was drafting off a trend that YouTubers had started, where, you know, one popular YouTuber would partner with another one and mm-hmm. basically combine their audiences.
Right.
And I thought that was a really interesting innovation in marketing also. You know, I have a branding and marketing background. I spent 20 years in that category. Mm. And I think that is now also coming forward into the leadership suite.
Yep.
Where leadership is so complex. The world is so different that one leader going it alone, or even one leader like leading a group of people, is no longer, I think, sufficient and maybe not even possible.
Mm.
And so the great leaders are finding more partnerships, recognizing that, in fact, if they emphasize their strengths and find a partner who can build on the places of relative weakness, then that's the way to real success. We talk about it all the time, this idea of comparative advantage. Mm. Like, we each want to spend more of our time in the places of our own genius and less of our time in the places where, you know, we may even be good. But if you can spend more time in your genius and less time in your good, then you can have a much bigger impact.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a very funny, you know, everyone should know this because it's intuitive. But what's the defining feature of a leader? Mm. Is there someone who has followers, right? And essentially, if you think about those followers as partners, as collaborators, as people that are going along on the journey with you, then in a way, the people who partner the best, of course, would tend to be the best leaders.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, I have to also just say, like, I feel really lucky. We both feel very lucky that we have created this unusual partnership where, you know, I would say, especially like 4 years ago when we just got started on this, it's sort of unlikely that, you know, we could have come together with the kind of trust and recognition of each other's abilities to form, merely a partnership, no better way to describe it, to be able to go forward. The dimension that we can see in because of our dramatically different life experience, but our fully consistent goals and objectives is in and of itself a superpower.
Yep.
We actually, at some point, it came to light and we read a book, I think it was called The Powers of Two,
mm-hmm.
That talked about, for example, Lennon and McCartney. Like, individually, it turns out, if you kind of break it down, individually, neither one of them would have been particularly successful. They were just too much of an outlier or whatever. But together, they were sort of an indestructible force. And I think, you know, I attribute a lot of our success to that power of partnership that we've been able to find and nurture.
Let me double click on that for a minute, because one of the really interesting parts of a partnership is the parties, whether it's two individuals, two organizations, two countries, finding a way to collapse the time to trust. And Reid Hoffman will often say that, you know, trust is consistency over time. So what were some of the things that you two did on meeting to galvanize that version of trust that you went, actually, no, there's something here?
Mm-hmm.
What were those things that happened, those small acts that sort of made that real for you both?
Well, I think within the first week of meeting one another and starting to discuss what working together would look like, I think there was just this really beautiful moment where I felt like I knew we were mm-hmm. going to have a great partnership. And it was, we were just catching up either before or after another call, and you were telling the story of your daughter and mm-hmm. the way that you see her so fully. And we're just describing the ways that you admire her and the things you were learning from her. And it was just this just beautiful moment where I said, oh, this is someone who really knows how to see and celebrate another. Mm. That's someone that I want to work with.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. It was pretty clear to me from that moment.
Yeah. I think from my side, you know, and you know, arguably, you know, I had been developing the idea with Marshall for 4 years before we started the agency. We started the agency together.
Hmm.
So I was sort of like on an up to speed, you know, I was already up to speed a little bit. And I like to think one of my superpowers is being able to see other people fully, like really understand their greatness. It sounds almost trite, but, it's a lot of, my work in branding is seeing companies fully. Mm. My work as a photographer actually was being able to see the person I was working on. I did a lot of portrait photography, see the person I was working with fully and being able to present them in a photograph. And so when I met Jacqueline, not only, you know, I could see she had already, she was 25 when I met her, just turned, well, she, you know, she just won 30 under 30, Forbes 30 under 30. So that's no secret of her age. So she was 25 at the time, but already had been, unbeknownst to me, like super accomplished, you know, had graduated like incredibly high in her class at Oklahoma State, mm-hmm. OSU. Had gone to Cambridge and did a master's in sustainable development. Had been, you know, quite a upcoming star at Phillips 66. And when I met her, I just realized the extraordinary potential. And the idea of working with someone who had extraordinary potential that could be, you know, it's compound interest. If you can grow extraordinary potential early, the benefits of that really pay off over time.
And it's transformative to be seen so fully in that way. From my perspective, that was, you know, it was a massive catalyst.
Yeah. And then, like you're saying, it's consistent over time. So the more we collaborated, and the more, you know, the more we were open and trusting and doing things together, the more we realized that we each not had each other's back, but we were just like working together in the same direction.
While we've had very different life experiences, to say the least, we found that we had a united heart and a real commitment to leadership and to growth, and that we both love people and love bringing people together, natural community builders. I would say I really value generosity. I'd like to think of myself as generous, but Scott is one of the most generous people that I've known. And, you know, just that those values alignment, and then I think compounded by the gift of the pandemic to us in the sense that we had a lot of time. You know, no one's traveling as much. There are no events. And so we just had this luxurious amount of time to get to know one another and really develop our relationship, develop a plan for the business, and then to begin executing it. And, you know, it was really right time,
right
place.
And then the process of writing the book just really doubled down on everything.
I can well imagine that. Yep.
It was very intense. And, but we saw, I mean, there were definitely like places where we had a healthy tension.
Sure.
But in general, we really knew what we wanted to accomplish with the book and what we wanted to communicate, and ultimately came up with this sort of becoming coachable was the impetus for the book, recognizing that there had been no book out there for helping people understand what it meant to be prepared for coaching, which is really the insight at the beginning of the book. But the book revealed to us in the process of writing it that our real purpose for writing the book was this concept of human flourishing, which is sort of part three of the book, which is really why be a leader at all. Right. And it was such a powerful thought.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me when we look back on a journey and a process like that, there is a way to dissect, and there is a very consistent model that I continue to see with, like I said, individual partnerships, company partnerships, and ones between countries, where there is that level of trust which has been forged quite quickly, often under circumstances which are uncommon. There is the ability to see both sides of the other party quite fully and in a way which is leaning forward or leaning into whatever the mission of that other individual or party or company is. Some of the greatest partnerships that I've been very fortunate to sit in the middle of and mediate to find the deal terms at the end of those are ones where ordinarily, the terms of the contract would be a lot more specific. And one of the commonalities is that the intent, there is so much time spent on the intention of the language that's inside the actual contract itself. And of course, all the downside risks and all the normal commercial things are taken care of. But there is such generosity in the intent of the agreement, which means that if they have to revisit through some kind of issue that comes up 2 or 3 years down the track, and they revisit the terms express the intent and bring people right back to why it was started in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating to think about, why is it that so many partnerships fail? It's often because the intention at the very beginning of that partnership was glossed over. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess that leads to my next question. when you see the tales of partnerships not working well, and that could be in a coaching context, it could be in a large commercial context, do you see something similar, or are there things that other factors that tend to play a role in bringing those partnerships to an end?
Yeah, we it's a little oblique answer, but I think I'll get there. So 2.5 years ago, we were about almost 2 years into sort of the beginning of our work. We were growing pretty quickly, and we were growing so quickly that we realized we had to be more efficient. We thought we realized that, so we started moving towards efficiency, and we put some systems in place. And we realized pretty quickly that efficiency just wasn't us. It didn't feel natural or true to us. And we examined a little further. We realized that by focusing on efficiency, we were prioritizing transactions, right? And so we came up with this philosophy that has been our philosophy ever since, which is that we're a relationship-first company, not a transaction-first company. Mm-hmm. And that everything we do is about supporting the relationships that we're in with the people that we meet. And, you know, philosophically, we're like, well, transactions are going to happen just in the very nature of things, but it doesn't matter to us. What matters is that we put relationships first. And we discovered that on an offsite in July and implemented it in July. And it was such a breath of fresh air for us. And we tell people about it very openly. We actually call it like the fifth dimension. Relationship is the fifth dimension. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, looking back at sort of the beginnings of our relationship, we are both relationship first people. And the need for figuring out the terms of a transaction are really unimportant. In fact, there are some things we have to put in for legal reasons.
Sure.
Just because. But we don't really call things contracts. We call them agreements. Mm-hmm. And the point of an agreement is just setting the terms forward and the recognition that there's never any intent. You know, a lot of people say, like, I never intend to sue. Like, ours is literally, like, we want to know when something's not working, we're just going to walk away in agreement. But there's not a situation set up where suing is going to be an answer. Mm. Because we're in agreement that we're going to be doing this together. We've been clear on the terms of how we're going to work together, and our intention is to be in relationship. And that construct serves us really, really well.
I think it's a hugely valuable construct. When I find that in the very early idea stages of any kind of partnership, I was helping assist with one in defense and aerospace recently, and one of the first people to walk into the room when I arrived was the lawyers. Mm-hmm. And I asked them if it was possible for them not to be part of this step in the process, because there is an intention step that needs to be forged, and just the speed at which you're able to, you know, come to an agreement and implement it straight away is a very clear sign that there is a commonality and a melding of minds that makes it actually, it'll just make it easier if we do this now. And the speed at which you can execute is one of the metrics for that. Tell me a little bit about if you both look at your respective histories before you came into this work, what were the partnerships that you would look at now that you know a lot more about partnerships and you look back in history? What are the ones that you look at and think, geez, that is a really fantastic partnership, which I want to keep in the back of my mind as one of the exemplars? And I ask this question because everybody has very different lenses on what this looks like. It could be at a brand level, it could be at a human level. What are the ones that stick in your mind as the really fantastic ones?
Just to clarify, partnerships that we were in or just partnerships that we've observed historically?
Just ones you've observed historically. And look, we can go to ones you've been part of, but I often find that people will have a romantic and often stronger view of the ones they saw from afar.
I think the most formative one for me personally is my parents. Mm-hmm. Because my parents work together. You know, my dad's a surgeon, my mom's a nurse practitioner, and they have two private practices together. And when I was in high school, my first job was as a medical assistant, you know, the person who takes your blood pressure and O2 levels and things like that, and says the doctor will be with you shortly. That and I was there that I saw a totally different side to my parents' relationship. Not only are they great, you know, partners to one another at home and partners in parenting, but in a professional context, I saw the love and respect that they had for one another, the way that they both elevated one another and their work was, they were just in this like lockstep, in their work. And, I really saw that and said, oh, I want to have that someday in a professional context. That would be a good one for me. Yeah. But of course the book Powers of Two, which Scott mentioned earlier, is a fantastic read that I love and outlines many of history's great partnerships.
Mm-hmm. I spent a couple decades in branding. I was a brand and innovation strategist. And in the world of advertising and branding, it's just well known. People work and they call them creative pairs. Hmm. And creative pairs is, you know, a copy guy and an art guy.
Yep.
Right. And on the surface, you'd think, oh, like one person's in charge of writing and the other person's in charge of, you know, the graphic and the design and whatever things look like. In reality, great creative pairs work as one mind, where the writing, the visual and the storytelling actually are almost one and the same. And I think that's also true in songwriting. Marshall lives in Nashville now. We spend a fair amount of time among musicians and songwriters and things like that. They talk about the same kind of thing where, and I think I'd sum it up like this. The ego of the individuals melts away. And the two people see themselves as one unit. And you'll hear them say things like, not even sure who came up with that lyric or who came up with that melody or who came up with the idea for this graphic or who came up with that phrase. And I think what's telling about that, not only is, you know, they've kind of become this one unit, but they're not attached to the authorship for themselves. Mm-hmm. They're celebrating the success of them as a unit. And I think that's a really telling sign.
Absolutely. Well, it reminds me of that story about the first two people to summit Everest. And now, of course, their names escape me. But the point is, neither of them would ever say who got there first. It was, we did it together. You know, that's it.
Jacqueline, your background in sustainable development and the work you've done in and around that, I'm just curious. More leaders that I can see now are understanding the implications, not just of environmental impact and social contracts and compacts that need to happen to make the world work. Some people ignore it altogether and just look at the bottom line, and that will always be the case. But where you see leaders having to grapple with so many shades of gray and work out, how do I make all of this work to satisfy as many of these stakeholders as I can to make my organization not just move forward, but try and be navigated through our new world of AI and beyond. What do you think these leaders are trying to understand and work with in terms of how they form partnerships? Because the thesis that I have around this is, in order to thrive, partnerships will only have to become more and possibly more intricate and complicated. And at business school, we were never taught about this. And as we were going through our careers, there is not a class you take often on what this is. We're trying to work this out as best we can. And that's why I guess the human factor of this is so important to try and forge that connection. So I guess my question is, how do you think leaders are going to have to think about partnerships in the next decade?
This is one of my absolute favorite topics, so I'm really glad we're going here. When I was in grad school, remember one of the early lessons or announcements from some of the program directors was, we are now at the point, in our world and for the planet, where a technical solution will not save us. Where the odds that we will somehow invent a new technology or something will happen, some magic will occur, and you know we're gonna resolve conflict, we're gonna resolve climate change, we're gonna resolve any number of things, is almost none. It's very, very slim. And so in realizing that, you have to say, well, then people, We need people. People are the solution. These people problems that we've ignored for a long time need to be addressed. And the funny thing is, you know, typically when people talk about different challenges, they say, oh, well, we'll just take it away. The trash will just go away. The recycling will just go away. Well, away doesn't mean away. Away just means somewhere else.
Somewhere else, right.
And yeah. An incredibly interconnected world. We have to become more and more aware of that. Marshall uses the term referent group a lot. You know, how do you draw your circle? Do you draw your circle as being my family, my town, my country? And really, increasingly, we're seeing people draw the circle even bigger and say, my referent group is my world, the world.
Yep.
And if we can really think about this idea, and this is why I love the concept of flourishing, and this was what we ultimately came to, is, I mean, while I love the word thrive, thrive, I think, sometimes has this context that I can be thriving and someone else can be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But flourishing, just kind of the natural connotation, at least for me, is we can only flourish if we're all flourishing together.
Mm-hmm.
There's an environmental context to that. And so as much as we can emphasize those things that are a win for the most parties, the better. And so that's, I think, a challenge that leaders are thinking about today is how can I draw my circle bigger? And how can I focus on the wins that are going to play the long game, that are going to last the longest for the most people?
Hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with her. No, I mean, there's no... you know, you can have short-term wins for yourself.
Hmm.
One of the things, so we are, you know, not only we're surrounded by a lot of leaders, CEOs, major companies, and also through the magic of Marshall, people who have been CEOs, leaders of companies, but are now retired. And to a person, everybody who is no longer in that role has regrets that they didn't do more for more people.
Yes.
Right? To a person. It's almost like that, and this is really I think it's a little trite, but you know the thing where you're like, if you could speak to yourself on your deathbed kind of thing, what would you change? It's amazing how universal it is that people, you know, kind of wished that they would have done more for more people. And, you know, maybe it's easy to say after the fact, but less for themselves. But I think that idea is filtering more and more, not yet into the C-suite, but, you know, if I look at down the future a little bit, and we do a lot of that kind of, you know, that's a lot of our thinking is what's going to happen 1-2 generations from now, what's happening in, you know, Gen Z, millennial, they are starting to think with more of a collective mentality.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it is because they recognize that the environment is not going to be as friendly for them if they don't take care of it today.
Mm.
And I think that there's not the same kind of universal distribution of abundance that there might have been 20 or 30 years ago.
Correct.
And almost by definition, there's more sense of collective. And I think that leaders, when we hear from leaders in the C-suite, we either hear one of two things. Either they don't understand what to do about it, or they're wrestling to understand it. But I think it's one of the topics where, you know, we go to a lot of HR conferences and leadership conferences, we in conversation with people. I think it's becoming and will continue to become a major topic.
Yeah, I think short-termism is also one of those big challenges. And I'm going to mention this concept. Scott brought up this idea that one Native American concept is this idea of seventh generation impact, that decisions are made on that kind of a time horizon. And what's beautiful about that is you're completely removed from that equation.
Mm.
That's long past your life, and you're probably totally forgotten to the world by then. But if you think on that kind of a time horizon, what I do today that can have the most positive impact seven generations from now, it's a powerful reframing.
It's a very consistent one across Asia as well. And so whenever I do business across Asia and have done before, you are very quickly reminded that the decisions that are going to be made will not be made quickly, not because there is not a desire for progress. It's because they're contemplating the implication. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very, it's such a nice reminder when, you know, if you're hustling hard, if you're trying to get things done, there is an implication, and that implication just needs to be thought about in a very different context compared to what your little circle might be mm-hmm. telling you at the time. I'm curious about one last thing before we get into some more fun questions about your backgrounds. When you think about this desire for leaders to say openly, and openly it could be in a very confidential environment, I don't know what to do.
Mm.
And I say that because in the CEO group that I am part of, where we have very open and very vulnerable conversations around not just partnerships, but a whole range of different topics. It can come from, you know, the health that we have, the concerns we have, the way we were trying to communicate, obviously on most days not doing a great job of that, and trying to work that out. You know, how should leaders be thinking about not the idea of just vulnerability for the sake of being vulnerable, but the way of having courage to find people that they can have those very difficult conversations with? Because my fear for anyone who is in a leadership role is that the expectation they place on themselves, and maybe others do as well, around you have to have the answers. And of mm-hmm. course, we'll help you have those conversations, but a whole range of incentives mean that that can't happen, really. How do you encourage leaders, if you separate out your coaching work, how do you encourage leaders to find a place to have those conversations?
Yeah, so certainly your coach is a great place to have that conversation.
Sure.
And I would also say, and I think this is a little bit of advanced leadership thinking, openly admitting that you don't have answers is an incredibly strong place for a leader to be.
Mm.
Right? We're in a complex world. We don't have all the information that we'd like to have to make decisions. And more, we don't have all the answers. We don't know. And even worse, there may be somebody out there in your team, in your company, in the world, that does have the answer. And if you pretend to have the answer, they're not going to tell you.
Mm.
So by opening up the possibility that you don't have all the answers, you're going to increase the potential to actually get the answers you need. And there's an incredibly wonderful story by a friend of ours, Hubert Joly, who is the CEO of Best Buy. And his book, I think The Heart of Business, probably talks about this. He teaches it now at Harvard. Mm-hmm. But the story, very quickly told, goes like this. He was a very successful CEO. I think Carlson mm-hmm. Was the company. Marshall was his coach. He gets the job to be the CEO of Best Buy. Why he took it, we will never know. The category was collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
The
company was in free fall. The analysts all had to sell. I think the share price might have been $1, like on its way to being delisted. Circuit City, another big box electronics company in the United States, had already collapsed.
Hmm.
So here he is. He goes in. But, you know, he's a super smart guy, always the smartest guy in the room, you know, McKinsey, whatever. Goes in, does an analysis. He goes, I have no answers here. Like, I cannot figure out how to save this company. And so he and Marshall come up with this idea that he's going to go out into the field and talk to employees. And in a very Marshall style, like Hubert would go into the store. He talks about going to, I think it's St. Cloud, right? Mm-hmm. St. Cloud, because he's French. So he's like, it should be Saint-Cloud. But he goes to the store at St. Cloud. He walks into the store. He says, attention, everybody. My name's Hubert Joly. I'm the CEO of Best Buy. I don't know how to save the company.
And I need your help.
And he said, I need your help became my favorite expression. Because the employees knew how to save the company. And 5 years later, the company was thriving, 18, like, I don't know, some huge multiple of success. But it was because he listened to the people who actually had the answers instead of trying to be the smartest guy and pretending that he had the answer.
Scott, I'm going to build on that just for a minute. If you indulge me with this story, there is one of the most profound leadership experiences I witnessed was coming out of the military. I needed to find a job, but that job found me answering phone calls at a banking call center. And this was my first non-military experience, so I really didn't know what was going on. But it was at the time, and this will date me, internet banking wasn't really a thing yet, but phone mm-hmm. banking was. And so we had tens of millions of calls coming in every year, and typically they were people who were retired just wanting to know if their government check had come in so they could go and do the shopping, right? So they didn't have to leave the house to do it beforehand. And they thought this idea of being able to make a call to understand that was revolutionary, because in their entire careers they would take their passbook to the bank and the teller would tell them if they've got money or not. One day I rock up in this very large call center, feeling very gray man. And there was a gentleman sitting next to me who was in a collar and tie, and he was answering phone calls. And he was dressed so differently and was so different in age that I it just made no sense to me. So in a very brief moment of breaks between calls, I took off my headset and I said, "Hey, look, I haven't seen you here before. I'm Phil." And he said, "Hi, I'm John." And I'll use his name here because I think it is one of those leadership lessons. His name is John Mulcahy. In Australia, he is one of Australia's most respected business leaders. And I said, "Oh, John, so you know, how long have you worked at the bank?" Now, look, I'm 23 years old. I know nothing. And he says, I've been here about 4 years. "Oh, good. At the call center?" And he said, no, at the bank. And I said, "Oh, interesting. Well, it's lovely to meet you." And then I realized that all these people around him that would walk past were treating him very differently to how they would treat a call center consultant. I said, "John, sorry, what's your job here?" And he said, "I'm the chief executive." And so every month he would either himself or his team and his team would go and spend time on calls at the front line, listening, learning, absorbing. Absolutely. And from that second on, my military experience had taught me whenever you need to understand how to fix something, make a beeline to the front line. Whatever you do, just get there. That happens now in our business. Anytime I need to understand something, the key requirement is I spend time at the front line to understand the organization. And John Mulcahy taught me that in the commercial context. So I am not surprised at all to hear that story. And if you are a leader watching or listening to this, and you've got questions about what's going on, your next move is to get straight to the front line and spend time there regularly. So I'll just leave it at that.
That is a perfect build. That's great. We may use that story.
please do. Yeah. Please do. And I don't think John, I know John, I don't think he realizes how profound that was, that moment was. It was quite something. Yeah. Now, before we get to our rapid fire, I just wanted to ask, where can people learn more about your fantastic work and you both respectively as operators in this business? Where can we point people to?
Well, I will, of course, now recommend Scott has a fantastic newsletter that he works very hard on every week. And it's all of Scott's latest leadership lessons and insights. It's this beautiful reflection on everyday moments and the leadership lessons therein. So you can find that on
LinkedIn. Yeah, it's on Substack also, too. But LinkedIn. You know, our website is 100coaches.com. So you're going to find us there. And, of course, we're both on LinkedIn. You know, Jacqueline just had this spectacular year. I like to say, like the tree of her year, she climbed Mount Kilimanjaro with her mom.
Awesome.
20 year dream fulfilled. We were named, top 50 influencers in the world of coaching by Thinkers 50. And then she got that 30 under 30 thing. So her, LinkedIn profile is quite robust, and fun. And, yeah, I mean, that's really, I think LinkedIn and our website is really the nexus of our activity.
And of course, our book is available on Amazon and where you can find books these days, or you can go to becomingcoachable.com and see more information there. Of course, we have a lot of detail about how we work and some of our leadership philosophies in our book, and hope people love it.
We will point people to that right now. So as you start to listen to the rapid fire questions, scroll to the show notes and find those links there. And I'm sure anyone listening to this is great at multitasking, so they can listen and find out more details as we go. Now,
right.
Five rapid fire questions to close us out. Jacqueline, I'm going to ask you these questions first, then Scott, I'll come to you. So let's see how we go here. And by the way, this you're not able to answer the same thing for the other person. So ooh, this is why we're going this first direction first. So Jacqueline, your first question. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
A way of life.
What content are you loving at the moment? And it can be anything, by the way. This doesn't have to be related to business, leadership, or anything else. It can be whatever you're enjoying.
Oh, man. That's such a good question. Currently, I am loving Nilofer Merchant's book, The Power of Onlyness.
Interesting. All right. So what's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
Oh, gosh.
That's a hard one.
Oh, gosh. Play it safe would be the worst advice.
I can't tell you how many people give me that same answer. Mm-hmm. All right. So when you see a potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
I think it's show up in relationship first. You know, that's at the end of the day is the win, is the relationship. And if there's something else that comes of it, that's great, but that's all gravy.
I couldn't agree more. All right, final question. What's one thing you are deeply grateful for right now?
An amazing team. We have fantastic partnership within our organization. It is the lifeblood of everything we do, and that's from the well from which all of our work stems.
All right, Scott, you're up. Here goes. Yeah. Here are the five. The five questions for you. All right, here we go. Complete this sentence. Partnership is.
I'm gonna quote Frances Hesselbein. Love made visible. Mm. Frances says, "Work is love made visible," but I think partnership is works too.
I agree. What content are you loving at the moment?
You know, sadly, the first thing that comes to mind is the Ezra Klein podcast.
Yes,
that
so good.
Jacqueline introduced me to. And it's just a potpourri of interesting people and a great dialogue. And I really love it.
That's awesome.
All right.
What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I think the worst piece of advice is whatever it is that was happening at the time, it was like, that's enough. It wasn't even like settle or anything else. It was just like the idea that whatever was happening was the end of the road and that there wasn't more there. And I just think that that those kind of self-limiting beliefs are some of the hardest barriers to overcome.
Yeah, I agree. So when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Okay, so I'll quote another great leader, Alan Mulally, who says, love them up. I think when if any relationship you're in, you want that relationship to be successful, just love them up and great things happen.
I agree. Generosity first. Very good. Mm-hmm. All right. And what's the one thing you're truly grateful for? By the way, whenever I say one, I don't know why we got this question wrong. It can be multiple things. So
yeah.
Tell me about that.
I mean, obviously, partnership with Jacqueline, like that's got to be number one. The truth is, like, since you're like opened it up, I am blessed with great partnerships all over my life.
Hmm.
I have the luck. I mean, it's really just good fortune to attract amazing people. And those amazing people become amazing communities. And I'm just encircled by all these communities with the intention of those communities. We're all in alignment about creating flourishing in the world. Hmm. And the ability to do phenomenal things with people that you love and respect is about the biggest gift you could possibly imagine.
Could not agree more. That is, you've nailed it. Jacqueline Scott, this has been such a tremendous time to spend together. I do hope it is the start of many conversations. Thank you for making the time. And we are about to go into the holidays. So if it's celebrated on your side, Merry Christmas. I hope you have a fantastic time with friends mm-hmm. and family. And the 2025 is your best year yet.
Yeah. Thank you so much,
Thanks,
Phil.
You too, Phil. This has been a real treat.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.